It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Senator Graham would attempt to put a nominee for the vacancy on the Supreme Court in front of the Senate, despite an election being in November. So right now they're using his words from the 2016 denial of a nomination for Merrick Garland in the Obama administration, using those words against him out in front, being played through loudspeakers as part of a wake-up call, they say, for Senator Lindsey Graham.
All right, so that's what happened in Washington, D.C. Over the last 24 hours, Lindsey Graham's house harassed, lasers shown into his home. And so you might think that Senator Lindsey Graham, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, might be intimidated by those protesters. But I don't think so. In fact, this is what he said last night on Sean Hannity. Let's listen.
We've got the votes to confirm Justice Ginsburg replacement before the election. We're going to move forward in the committee. We're going to report the nomination out of the committee to the floor of the United States Senate so we can vote before the election. That's the constitutional process. After Kavanaugh, everything changed with me. They're not going to intimidate me, Mitch McConnell, or anybody else. Name one liberal justice nominated by a Democrat that had their life ruined. They're talking about changing the Electoral College. If they keep the House, the Senate, and the White House, this country will change fundamentally. The only thing stopping them is you, the voter.
All right, so that was Lindsey Graham. So I think they're moving full steam ahead. So far, they have not lost. Lindsey claims they have the votes. We have not heard yet from Mitt Romney. The Republicans are supposed to meet today and talk about what they're doing, and he's going to make a statement afterwards. But they can afford to lose him with Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and still bring in Vice President Pence and have the votes. So it seems like at this point, it looks like the Republicans are in pretty good shape. The other side of this is, of course, Vice President Biden, who's running for president, as you know, on the Democratic side, has refused to issue a list of his nominees. And that's very important. He's been asked to do that. Let's listen to Peter Ducey talk about that, clip one.
Dozens of Biden and Trump supporters showed up to cheer, or jeer, his closed to the public event in Wisconsin.
I don't pledge allegiance to red states of America or blue states of America. I pledge allegiance to the United States of America.
Biden wants the winner of the election to nominate the next Supreme Court justice, but he won't release a list of possibilities unless he wins.
It's no wonder the Trump campaign asked that I release the list only after she passed away. It's a game for them.
The president actually called for that list more than a week before Justice Ginsburg passed.
He must release a list of justices for people to properly make a decision as to how they will vote.
On Sunday, Biden also misstated the COVID-19 death toll.
It's estimated that 200 million people have died, probably by the time I finish this talk.
All right, that's enough of that. But I just wanted you to see that Joe Biden has refused to issue a list. Now, there's speculations this morning that it will be Stacey Abrams, Xavier Becerra, who is the Democratic Attorney General in California, and there are others. So we'll get into that. But I want us to talk today about who the nominees are on the top list for President Trump, because it's important. And we're only going to have a few minutes here to do a lot of information. Phil Jaggery is the founder of the Judicial Action Group. Phil is all over this stuff, and I've asked him to join us this morning. Phil, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Sandy. Thanks a ton.
Okay, so now we know it's going to be a female. The president has declared that, and there are three, at least, that I want to talk to you about, unless something's happened this morning that I don't know about. The top person on the list is Amy Coney Barrett. A president met with her at the White House. I think, as far as we know, that's the only person he's met with so far. Doesn't mean that's the end of it. It's just the first. You're high on Amy, and I want to know why.
Well, I'll tell you a brief story, but it was 2017 summer, and I was researching judicial nominees, as we do. That's our job. And so, you know, every nominee that comes before the Senate has a questionnaire that talks all about the person, their writings, their, you know, everything they can list down about their career. Well, I pick up one to research a new nominee to the Seventh Circuit. Again, this is what I do, and as I'm reading through it, didn't even really catch the name because that wasn't important. I was looking at everything, and the more I read, I thought, who is this? And I looked back, and the name was Amy Coney Barrett. And as I dug into her judicial philosophy, Sandy, I've researched, I think you know this, but going back to the beginning of the Obama administration and his nominees, I've researched nominees, so I've looked at hundreds, literally hundreds. And through President Trump's administration, he's had over 2,000 confirmations of judges. And I'll just say Amy Coney Barrett's judicial philosophy is the best I've ever seen. It's not even close. Nobody comes close to her judicial philosophy. And that's not even taking into account the personal story. And I think the courage that she has and the values that she has. She is a truly unique nominee, and she's exactly what we need. The left had their values, and they were put into a person called RBG. Our values are put into somebody called ACB. She's by far the best, and my hope and prayer is that she'll be nominated and confirmed quickly to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it really will transform this nation. And that's why the left is manifesting and freaking out in the street, because they know what's coming and they can't stop it.
All right, let's talk about the other person who seems to be the two names that are mentioned. There's a third one that's just come up, and we'll touch on that too. Barbara Lagoa, who is a Cuban-American judge.
Yeah.
In Florida. She's on the 11th Circuit. Some Floridians are very high on her. I just want to know what your thoughts are about her, Phil.
Yeah. So here's the thing about Barbara Lagoa. She seems like a nice person, has a nice story. I've yet to hear one thing of one of her supporters say about her that qualifies her to be a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. There's a standard that we measure these folks by. It's not just someone throws out a name, and then the burden shifts to the other person to then prove everything that's wrong with that person. The person coming forward with a name, the prospect has a duty, a burden to say why this person deserves a 30 to 40 year stint on the U.S. Supreme Court. The standard, by the way, is we're looking, and I'd tell your listeners, listen to this standard and think whether you agree. We are looking for someone with a long-term record of courage, conservatism, and a constitutional judicial philosophy. We're not looking for somebody who showed up last week and gave a nice speech. And I'm not saying that's Barbara Lagoa. I'm just painting a picture. We need somebody with a long-term record of courage, conservatism, and a constitutional judicial philosophy. I haven't heard one person make the case that Barbara Lagoa qualifies for that with actual evidence. What are her cases? What are her speeches? What are her law review articles? What are her actions in her 52 years that qualify her under that standard to be the next justice? There's nothing there. And then we can talk about what might concern us about her. And I'll tell you, when she was confirmed 10 months ago, to the 11th Circuit, she received a majority of liberal Democrat senators voting to confirm her. Folks, that doesn't happen in this hyper-partisan environment that we're in. Judicial nominees don't get 27 liberal Democrat votes unless those 27 liberal Democrats are unafraid of that nominee, unless they're okay with them. And they were. Dianne Feinstein voted to put Barbara Lagoa on the bench. Patrick Leahy voted for her, and 25 other liberal Democrat senators. So that's not a yellow flag. That's a major red flag.
Yes, I don't disagree with you at all, Phil. And considering what we have, I think what I read a statistic that Republican presidents, 50% of the nominees they've made to the court have gone south. They haven't been conservatives at all. And, in fact, you know, Gorsuch just was... Oh, he's been so good on so many things, but what a gut punch the decision he made on the LGBT, the transgender case recently.
One of the worst decisions ever.
Yeah, really. Here he's done such good things, and he had such high hopes. I have to say, though, and I think you might agree with me, that we had some red flags about him that were ignored by others. So it shouldn't have been that much of a shock.
I know, and Sandy, that's why at this moment we have to be serious about vetting these prospects. I mean, everything's about Gorsuch we heard, and somebody kind of told us, I won't name names, but somebody said, "Don't worry about it. He's one of us. He'll never betray us." Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, okay, you know, so what we need to do is look at the evidence. And if people don't bring forward evidence and all they bring forward is a name and an endorsement and some nice-sounding phrase like this person's a home run or this person will never betray us or this person's a rock-rib conservative, tell them, show me the money. Where's the evidence? Where are their writings? Where's their life that supports them having this lifetime appointment? And if they don't have it, then the person may be the nicest person in the world, and they might actually be a constitutionalist, but if there's not evidence that they are, the person needs to not be considered at all.
Yeah, and we are, there are so many things I could say about this, but I think I'm going to save them for off the air. But let me just ask this, let me mention this last person. Yeah, I have to be careful. Sure. Allison Jones-Rushing is another person that's people are pretty high on. She's very young, 38. And they've been telling us that evangelicals are very high on her. What do you know about her, and is that true?
Evangelicals are very high on her. At least some are. I think there's a lot of potential in Allison Jones-Rushing, and I think what's attractive about her is her age. She's young, and where she comes from. But there are some concerns. You know, it's kind of like, you put anybody up top for a period of time and you start examining them and you start to see some things. And one of the things about Allison Jones-Rushing that concerns me, let me say this. When it comes to Amy Coney Barrett, the positive evidence in her favor on a scale of 1 to 10, she's probably a 9.5. There is so much out there that she's written and done for years. It's a deep, deep history, and it's a broad history. With Allison Jones-Rushing on a scale of 1 to 10 positive evidence, I would probably put it at a 3 or a 4. And that's not an insult. I'm just saying, if you're looking at data, okay, if we're looking at data, Barrett's like a 9.5. Allison Jones-Rushing is maybe a 3 or a 4 in terms of data. I'm not saying ultimately she couldn't be a 10. I'm just saying data on philosophy, she's a 3 or a 4 right now, okay? So you start to look at other things. Well, what might be negative evidence? What is out there that could be of a concern? And here's one thing that concerns me. On page 10 of her Senate questionnaire that she turned in, she talked about political activity that she's had. And one thing she did was she worked for the Romney campaign in 2012. That doesn't concern me so much. You know, it came down to Obama or Romney, and so I get it, no big deal. But the second one, in 2009, she worked for the campaign of a progressive Democrat who was running for the Maryland House of Delegates who was pro-LGBT marriage in 2009. He was elected. He voted for LGBT marriage in the Maryland House, ultimately ended up changing his position and being against LGBT marriage. But but at the early part of his campaign, he was pro-LGBT marriage.
Yeah. So that's a red flag.
Allison Jones-Rushing. Yeah, it's a major red flag. And it needs to be explained, or we don't know what to make of that other than on its face what it shows.
Yes, and this time around, we have to take this on with the grit of our teeth and not let go if we see a red flag. I'm like you.
Exactly.
I'm tired of just rolling over and saying, okay, I trust you, fill in the blank, because we do have to vet them very carefully. And that's what Phil is doing with Judicial Action Group. He does a great job with this, and especially from a Christian perspective. And by the way, American Family Association is supporting Amy Coney Barrett. We feel that she's the number one candidate as well, along with Phil. So, Phil, thank you so much. We appreciate your input and your hard work to vet these judges, these candidates on our behalf. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
That changed my life just from that ultrasound picture.
When it comes to choice, the Ministry of Preborn offers the ultimate life-saving choice by providing a free ultrasound. When an abortion-minded woman sees her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, she's 80% more likely to choose life.
I'm going to keep my baby, and I'm going to keep growing, and I'm going to be the great mom.
Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasounds in the country, and their mission is to help save babies' lives and souls through love and compassion and the message of Jesus Christ. To find out more, go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say baby. Your love can save a life.
This is Pause to Pray, a chance each day to stop down from the daily noise of life and pray for our country's leaders.
Today, we pray for Marie Royce, Assistant Secretary of State for Educational and Cultural Affairs. She leads the bureau that works to create mutual understanding between the people of the U.S. and people from other countries around the world. Galatians 3:28 reminds us we are all united under Jesus. There is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Almighty God, we ask for guidance for Marie Royce. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of this station and the Presidential Prayer Team. Get your free prayer resources to help you pray the vote this election season. Available right now at pausetopray.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
My goal as a teacher is to impart knowledge and then be able then for them to take it and turn it into wisdom. As we teach, I think, okay, 5 years down the road, how will the material that I am teaching them really affect their lives and their careers?
Hi, Todd Starnes here. Truett offers biblically-centered degree programs. Check out truett.edu/starnes. Republican lawmakers are concerned Democrats could resort to violence if President Trump nominates someone to fill the Supreme Court vacancy left by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death, and they have good reason to be concerned. Over the weekend, a number of high-profile leftists promised that Republicans would pay a price if they even try to replace RGB. We burn the entire thing down. That's what a former CNN host wrote on Twitter. I had to clean up the guy's language a little bit. He said a nominee would be confirmed over his dead body. Another Twitter user said Senate Republicans will need to live the rest of their lives in armor-protected cars and homes. It's unfortunate, but that's the reality of American political discourse. Republicans responded to Ginsburg's death with thoughts and prayers. Democrats responded with mob action. Be sure to listen to my national radio show live noon to 3 Eastern, and you can download my podcast at toddstearns.com.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
This situation turning deadly. According to authorities, the agent was trying to arrest a group of suspected illegal immigrants on the Arizona border overnight. One of the immigrants reportedly took out a knife and stabbed the agent multiple times. The agent then fatally shot his attacker. Authorities say he was airlifted to an area hospital. His condition is unknown. The incident taking place near the border town of Nogales, about an hour south of Tucson. Chief Border Agent of the Tucson Sector, Roy Villarreal, revealing preliminary details. The FBI will lead this investigation into the shooting, and more information will be released later.
Sandy Rios back with you. You know, it hasn't been that long ago that we were completely absorbed with what was happening at the border. That was a story that just happened last night, by the way. Trust me, there are people on the border who are still consumed by what's going on at the border because they're trying to keep us from being invaded by, drug smugglers and criminals who have been coming across the border. And there has been so much discussion. President Trump, of course, campaigned in 2016 on, building a wall and protecting a border and returning American sovereignty, and you fill in the blank. Well, he is now campaigning again, but all eyes are on, the judicial process, which we've been talking about. But the other issue that remains important is that issue at the border. And this morning, joining me from the White House is Theo Wald. Theo is the Deputy Assistant for the President for Policy in the Office of American Innovation. He has a, this is kind of cool, Theo, excuse me, I'm going to embarrass you for a second. He has a BA from Georgetown University, studied government English there. Now, Theo, I just have a, I'm going to get personal with you for a second. Did you learn anything at Georgetown University that you could use in your current position?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Sandy. It's a great question. You know, I think the advice I always give to, you know, families with kids who are going through the college process is, you know, having bright, shiny credentials isn't all it's cracked up to be. But what you really need are good mentors and good professors. So I was very fortunate at Georgetown to be connected with a number of very great Americans, one in particular, Father James Shaw, who was just a first-rate first-rate political philosophical mind, but also had a huge heart for Jesus and incredible mentor for me. So as far as what I learned at Georgetown, I learned really two things. The left is eating our country from the inside out, and two, you got to stay close to Christ if you're going to make it. No matter what you end up doing, whether it's in politics or government, you name it. So that's what I took away from Georgetown.
Theo, I heard you speak at a White House briefing, probably maybe last year, maybe a little bit longer than that. And that's why I was really excited to talk to you this morning. I want to say a couple of more personal things, if I could. Theo has his Juris Doctorate from University of Notre Dame, so he must kind of have some familiarity with Amy Coney Barrett, which is an aside. We just got through talking about her. But the last thing, too, is just very personal to me. You have your Master's in Literature from University of St. Andrews, so that means you're okay with me, too, Theo, because my son is getting his PhD there right now, so... Anyway,
all right, that's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, my thing with St. Andrews is, I come from a working class family out in California, son of a carpenter, and I never in a million years thought I would be in a place like St. Andrews, where, I had a poetry class with Kate Middleton, and I learned to golf there and do all those kinds of things. So it was a real eye opener for me as far as the rest of the world, and especially being over there in Scotland, where every day is dark and drizzly, makes you really appreciate the weather I grew up with in California.
Yes, that's true. That's a very good point. But Theo, I'm glad. Thanks for taking time to just lay that out a little bit, because one of the things that I have been appreciating again so much is the very fine people that are working in the White House now. A lot of people that I know well are surrounding the president, giving him great advice. I did not know who you were till I heard you present at the White House, and I didn't know these personal things about you till this morning. So you are a great example of the kind of people bringing their wisdom to the president, on a daily basis. All right, let's talk about your subject matter, which is immigration. And I think let's start with the fact that the president did obviously over and over promise that he would build the wall. And that's probably a big reason why he was elected in 2016, because it was being overrun and we were out of control. So where are we with the wall? We hear various reports from you, who knows what's going on in the border in terms of the building that border, first of all.
Yeah, so one thing I just say as a proviso up front is the remarkable thing about the president's accomplishments in the immigration space is something that anyone who's in a family who works a 9-to-5 job, it's something that's a part of your life day to day anyway, but it's revolutionary in Washington, which is the president's actually done what he said he was going to do. It's that simple. It's profound here in D.C., but it is truly something that no other modern president has really made a center point of their administration. Do what you said and what you promised the American people you do. So on the wall, we're about at 400 miles of total construction, and we're now at a pace where we're putting up a new mile of border wall every day. And when you think about the fights that we had, that we were in the midst of from day one, the legal fights, the legal challenges, whether it was with property owners that the Democrats paid to put up fights, court challenges from leftist advocacy groups, and then also the funding fights, actually just getting the money to move forward with construction. It's remarkable what we've been able to do, and now at this pace of a mile a day, we're going to be, this time next year, we're going to be in a tremendous place. And the last thing I'd say on the wall is just, I received a briefing last week from some of our operators down there, and every single guy or gal in our law enforcement along the southern border will tell you the wall is making a difference, and we can see it in real time as the trafficking networks, as the drug cartels all have to realign their positions, find new routes, and that's increasing our ability to interdict and stop them. So all those people who somehow forgot, 200, 400 years of fortification techniques, who said, walls don't mean anything, walls don't work. It turns out walls actually really do work, and they're making a big difference for the safety and security of Americans in their own communities.
Well, I imagine that it's probably hard to quantify that right now, because I'm sure that the whole COVID outbreak and other factors have sort of shut things down a bit at the border. And so let's talk about that for a second. For months, we watched the flood of immigrants. We watched the march from South America and Central America. It was really a nightmare and just very distressing. What's happening now in terms of, we just heard that report at the top of this segment about a border agent being stabbed to death. In terms of volume and control, what are we seeing down there now coming across the border legally or illegally, I mean?
Yeah, so here's the important thing. The battlefield along our southern border is never going to be static. There are lots of really bad people around the world who understand our system of immigration law and understand the poorest parts of our security infrastructure and are always looking to game it out. So there will never be a final battle where everything is completely secure. But we've made enormous progress. And as you noted, the travel restrictions imposed by the president because of the pandemic have restricted a lot of the flow. But at the same time, one of the other things that everyone, all the smart people in Washington laughed about was the president said, I'm going to go to Central America and Mexico, and I'm going to negotiate some immigration agreements with those governments. And they are going to help us fix their problem, which is these mass caravans, people fleeing their cities and towns and coming north. And we're going to get those governments to do something about it. And all the smart people said, this is going to blow up in the president's face. Good luck. No one's ever been able to do that. Well, the president got an agreement with the Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and he got an agreement with Mexico. Everything that people said couldn't be done, the president did. And now those agreements have helped us stem the flow, have helped us identify major cartels, trafficking networks, and have really put a stop to the caravans. Irrespective of the pandemic, the total volume has significantly reduced going forward from last October to where we are today.
One of the things that you talked about that I just found intriguing was when you laid out the whole vision of merit-based immigration. That was at the briefing, and that, again, it's been some time ago, and I know that you've made progress on that, but I know that there's so much more to be done. Can you say what the president has accomplished on establishing that and what you would hope to accomplish in another another term?
Yeah, so on merit-based immigration, there's a lot of folks who have very different views on what that would look like or what that should mean. But I think for the president, his vision of merit-based immigration is essentially skills-based immigration. The people coming to this country need to have skills that will make them or allow them to be employable so that they can have jobs from day one and contribute to this country. America is an incredibly generous nation. We all know that. But we also need people who are arriving here to be able to have skills that actually fit in a 21st century economy. So skills-based immigration is really the future for any country who's looking to compete with China or some of our allies in Europe. And so we are moving systematically to build that system from the ground up. And I'll give you a window into one of the things we're doing. The 9/11 Commission had in their report a number of recommendations, but one that was very essential for the security of our country, which was to improve our biometric information collection. So that's fingerprints, maybe ocular scans now. And to do that biometric collection before an individual immigrant gets on board a plane and comes to the United States. It probably won't surprise you, Sandy, but you know, for some of your listeners, it's probably shocking to hear that the United States is really one of the only developed countries in the world that does biometric information collection after people have already been given a visa to travel. So sometimes a person will arrive here in the United States and we'll say, shoot, turns out we ran your criminal background and we now know you've got a connection to Al-Qaeda or ISIS or something. No other country in the world does that. They do not give you a visa before they've actually run your background. They've scanned your information and they've got you on file. So what does that have to do with skills-based immigration? Well, setting up that information, the biometrics, fixing the identity of an applicant from the moment they fill out the first form to the point that we're making a decision on their request for a visa, we've got to do that in order to move more efficiently, to process the volume of applicants we have. But also, that's the first step to ensuring that when we're categorizing people, when we're using a points-based metric to sort of determine if they've got the skills that we need to make sure that we're talking about the same person from start to finish. So we're doing a lot of these building blocks unilaterally. We're not going to wait for Congress. We're going to move with the powers that the president under the law already has. And this time next year, people are going to be very surprised to find that we have really transformed our nation's legal immigration system.
Well, that's the part that never got discussed very much, except it did on this show, that legal immigration was as much of a problem nearly as illegal immigration. And I think that brings me to a question about one of the controversial areas that's tough for the president, too, I think. And I think it's the H-1B visas, where skilled workers or people who have, a technical knowledge and abilities get a special visa to come and work. And what's happened, and it's happened since I was on radio in Chicago in the late 90s, American workers, skilled workers, have been displaced. There have been famous stories about that. Disney World, lots of people displaced, having to train foreign workers. What about that?
Yeah, so I was very proud to work on the president's efforts with the Tennessee Valley Authority recently in the last few months. You may have seen that story. Some of your listeners may have seen it. The Tennessee Valley Authority is a federal agency. It was created by Roosevelt really as a jobs program for some of the depressed areas of the southeastern United States. But it's also an electrical utility. And the CEO of TVA had announced that he was going to gut about 300 engineering and IT jobs held by American workers and replace them with foreign labor at cut wages, all coming on the H-1B visa. And the president said, absolutely not. And he told the TVA to reverse course. They didn't, so he fired members of their board of directors. They got the message. They canceled the contracts with the consultancy firms. They moved the H-1B visas off of employment, and they reinstated the American workers. The importance of this action is that the TVA is a federal agency, so we could basically dictate terms, essentially, to them. Some of these companies, as you mentioned, Disney, Edison, right now we've got Vanguard investment firms announced they're going to gut 2,000 American workers and replace them with H-1B holders. So that's opened a new front for us, which is the H-1B visa cannibalizes the American workforce. The way it is constructed today, it's a cut wage. It has no real demonstrable criteria that insists that the H-1B
guys,
visa
hold the break,
holder
please.
Have...
Excuse me, have, I had to have, get talk yeah. to my... Hold on just one second, Theo. You guys hold the break for about 5 minutes, please. Okay, thank you. Sorry, Theo, finish your sentence. I just want to... Yeah. I didn't want the music to start yet.
Yeah, no, so I was saying is the H-1B visa, essentially, you're right, it has been a real wrecking ball for the opportunities for America's skilled workers. So here's the good news. We have a whole slate of regulations we're going to be unveiling in the next few weeks that are really going to transform the way the H-1B visa works. Does America need a certain number of talented, skilled, super brains coming in? Yeah, sure, of course. To remain competitive around the world, America has always been a place where smart people can come and make contributions. Do we need to be stealing opportunities from America's college graduates and putting America's engineers, IT professionals at the back of the line? Absolutely not. So this president wants at all costs to put the American worker first, and I think with this slate of regulations we're going to unveil here in the next few weeks, we're going to see some real change.
You know, Theo, I just was thinking, you and I both know that around the world, it is absolutely not Mexico, not in Canada for sure, not in Scotland for sure. Can Americans, anyone get precedence over native-born citizens in those countries? And no one does what we do. And, this issue came to my mind when I was in Chicago. I remember getting a call from someone, I think they worked at Motorola, in tears, talking about their being replaced. And all this was years ago. And it's the first time I'd heard of anything like this. There is real human cost to these bad policies, and they have hurt Americans now for decades. And so what you're doing really does matter and really does change people's lives, Theo. Anything else that you want to tell us in the remaining minutes about what you're working on and what people could expect in a second term for President Trump?
Yeah, so obviously we're going to move forward with, skills-based immigration reform. We're going to keep building the wall. But here's the thing, everyone will see the details in a number of documents we're going to be releasing. But the main, message I'd love to give your listeners is the positive side of immigration work. A lot of people say what the president's done on immigration is very fractious or divisive. I would say the corrupt bargain we had before, where multinational corporations, the swamp creatures in Washington, always put American workers last. That was divisive and fractious. But what the bargain the president is offering is that he will enforce the law. He's going to enforce the law, and he's going to always put the American worker first. So that way people can go about their business and live their life. So the positive side of the immigration story is that the American people benefit. American children have better opportunities down the road. American families will have the resources of this country at their fingertips, not spent on the children of other countries first. And you're right. I mean, look, anywhere else in the world, you go to New Zealand, Australia, you go to Canada, it is not controversial that their policies put their own people first. And so I don't think we should be, I don't think we should apologize for wanting to ensure that American citizens have a country not only that they can be proud of, but they can thrive in.
I think you touched on this just a second, but I want to ask about it. Social Security fraud, Medicare fraud, illegal immigrants draining our system and getting things that they should not be getting is an issue. And with Social Security, I think I heard that they're expecting it might will go bankrupt by 2024. I think that's the year that I read. What any efforts on that to tighten the rules and start actually enforcing and making sure that it's people who really do qualify for these benefits get the benefits?
Yeah, most certainly. So first off, we put out our public charge regulation, which has already been sued by a number of leftist organizations, but the law on public charge could not be clearer. It's been on the books for almost a century now, and the basic premise is if upon arrival at the United States, we know that day one you're going to get on entitlement benefits, then we don't have to admit you into this country. We need people who are going to pay their fair share and work. So that regulation is, as I said, it's going through the courts. We're going to win. You mentioned her at the top, but Judge Barrett on the Seventh Circuit had a great dissent from two liberal judges who tried to stop this regulation from going forward. It's worth everyone reading that dissent. But we're going to win on the merits of that. And then that allows us to build from there a number of reforms that have long overdue, so that the federal government, when it's giving out monies to states, as you know, states are the ones who ultimately pay out state governments a lot of these benefits. The federal government has for many years been stopped by the government in Illinois or New York, California, some of these so-called sanctuary jurisdictions, from seeing the accounting. Where are these benefits going? Who are you paying them to? Are they actually eligible recipients of these benefits? Well, this regulation, once it holds up in court, we're going to be able to build on that and finally get the accounting and ensure that we're running the cross-check to make sure that the taxpayers' money for benefit spending actually goes to American taxpayers, i.e. U.S. citizens. So stay tuned for that reform. It will be a big one.
And we will stay tuned and hope to talk to you about that again, Theo. Theo Wald, again, is the Deputy Assistant to the President for Policy in the Office of American Innovation. And I can say that Theo's ideas, many of them have been implemented, and innovation really properly does describe your approach to immigration. Theo. It's common sense, but it is innovative in a time of craziness. So, hey, listen, thank you. We so appreciate your time, and we appreciate your hard work there to help the president. Thanks, Theo.
Thanks, Sandy. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. All right, Sandy Rios, we need to take that break, you guys. Let's take a break. When we come back, I have a lot of other things to catch you up on, but I have this this piece of paper in my hand that talks about Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's immigration plan, and that the projection is that it would add 52 million new immigrants. It's the temporary protected status that they would be ensuing. More than $204 billion would be the annual net cost of illegal immigration by 2024. 43 million people made eligible for the family chain migration under an extensive amnesty program. And these are projections, but does it sound shocking to you that we would increase by millions the people that are on needing to be supported by the American government, courtesy of the U.S. tax dollars, if we allow more and more immigration? And that is exactly what they plan to do. So you need to know that. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
When it got chilly this winter, they issued an alert because the iguanas are so cold, a frozen iguana might fall on your head.
Focal Point with Brian Fisher.
I want my listeners to be able to defend the truth and the authority of the Word of God as it speaks to every area of life, family, culture, and even politics.
Weekdays at 1 p.m. Central on American Family Radio.
And we hope to have a little bit of fun along the way.
Okay, Brian, now make me believe it.
Being a pastor as many years as I was, especially early on, having to go to funeral homes, intensive care, you know, where people were hurting, I was always, what do I say? What do I say? You know what I found out? My presence spoke louder than anything else. It said, I care. Sometimes you're a blessing by being there.
Exploring Missions with Pastor Bird Harper, Saturday evenings at 6:30 and 8:30 Central on American Family Radio.
Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Merriam-Webster's dictionary defines socialism as an economic system in which the means of production are owned and controlled by the state. The distribution of goods are controlled by the state. It is a system where there is no private property. A stage of society, in Marxist theory, transitional between capitalism and communism. American socialists put the descriptor democratic in front of socialism because they hope to persuade you to vote for the elimination of private property. Make no mistake, socialism is socialism. There is no kinder, gentler form of it.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. Democrats are in a state of panic over President Trump's right to nominate the next Supreme Court justice. One possible hitch is that the Benedict Arnold Brigade among Senate Republicans seems to grow by the day. Lisa Murkowski is a self-declared no vote, and Susan Collins likely will be too. Who knows with Mitt Romney? He could vote against Trump just out of spite and to reclaim what's left of his 15 minutes of fame. But if the rest of the Republicans hang together, there will be 50 votes for Trump's nominee and Vice President Pence will break the tie. Democrats even now are furiously strategizing how to torpedo Trump. And Nancy Pelosi is even considering impeaching Trump again. The one thing we know is that things are going to get a lot more interesting before they get less interesting.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. What are we to make of President Trump's decision to approve conditionally the deal that would allow a Chinese digital Trojan horse known as TikTok to continue recruiting users in the United States? The good news is that dealmakers Oracle and Walmart say they can prevent the app from vacuuming up private data and other sensitive information from many millions of U.S. cell phones and other digital devices. The bad news is that the all-important algorithms that power TikTok may remain subject to the dictates of the Chinese Communist Party and therefore a threat. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has pledged, however, that, quote, we will ensure that the firewall is real that the protection is serious, that the data resides in places that aren't connected to the Chinese information system, unquote. Anything less is unacceptable and must result in TikTok being banned. This is Frank Affney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Whoever President Trump nominates would move the court firmly to the right, making it solidly conservative. One of the leading contenders clearly opposes abortion rights.
A devout Catholic, she's a favorite among religious conservatives.
Seven children, devout Catholic, she would energize anti-abortion activists and religious right.
The 48-year-old Barrett is a favorite of religious conservatives for her anti-abortion views.
All right, so just wanted to give you an idea of what we have ahead of us. Amy Coney Barrett, she was the one that, she is the top pick right now. She was the one who, in her hearing just last year, I think it was last year, man, the time goes so fast, Dianne Feinstein said basically, the dogma lives loud in you. Well, I know that sounds like a foreign language, but to Catholics, they use that term a lot, and she's talking about Catholic doctrine, Catholic teaching, Christian teaching, they're not necessarily the same thing. Catholics have teachings that go outside of what we as evangelicals consider biblical instruction. But Feinstein's talking about Catholic dogma, meaning the basic tenets of the faith plus Catholic teaching. The dogma lives loud in you. It was really an amazing moment. And, you know, we are not supposed to have a religious test in this country for confirmation for public service. That's very explicitly outlined in the Constitution, but they breached that, and you can imagine that they will roll up their sleeves and try to destroy her. I'm not sure what other issue they would. She's got a stellar personal story. She has seven children, and some of them adopted. One is disabled, and you'll be hearing more about her. We will be talking more about her. I want to give you just an idea of what's going on around the place, because the left is going crazy. They are threatening. You heard Nancy Pelosi, I think I played the clip yesterday, where they're talking about maybe impeaching the president again, and Bill Barr, to try to stop, you know, them from, you know, putting through this nominee. Yesterday, and this is the media weighing in on this, trying to sort of put ideas in the heads of, though they needed them, Democratic senators. Let's listen to this clip four.
If the Republicans manage to essentially steal a second Supreme Court seat, the only way that we restore fairness is for Congress to pass an act expanding the court.
Do you say Democrats, if they get back the Senate in this election in November, should then move to expand the Supreme Court?
Are you in favor of trying to expand the numbers of justices on the Supreme Court?
Like the idea of eliminating the filibuster, should they do that?
As you know, some Democrats are openly threatening to try to pack the Supreme Court with additional justices. Would you agree with that?
Potentially changing the number of justices on the court, changing the filibuster, changing the number of states in the union.
Adding seats to the Supreme Court and getting rid of the filibuster. Do you support those two things?
You know, there is nothing in the Constitution that says there has to be 9 Supreme Court justices.
One response from the Democrats might be to pack the court.
What we'll do is very simple. We'll add D.C. and Puerto Rico as states. That's 4 new senators. We'll add 2 new Supreme Court justices.
Will they really add the 2 seats?
Why wouldn't they?
Because they're weak and they're wimps and they're afraid.
I think that was a bad idea when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried to pack the court. And well, if anything would make the court appear partisan, it would be that.
Well, of course, that little last quote was not someone from the media. It was Ruth Bader Ginsburg weighing in on the whole idea of packing the court. And she very clearly stated what she thought about it. Of course, packing the court is simply, let's say the Republicans get this nominee through, and let's say the Democrats win, then they would pass some sort of a law to declare that there should be 11 Supreme Court justices, 12 Supreme Court justices, and they would go about the business of filling those roles and then swing the court in their favor. President Obama did this on the D.C. Circuit Court. He didn't like the way they were deciding things, and so he moved to the Congress, the Democratic Congress, to add seats on that court so that they would outweigh and outnumber the conservatives who were appointed for that court. So this is the kind of lawlessness we're talking about, and you can see that they are ready to do that, happy to do that, adding Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia, giving them senators so that they can now take over the Senate more fully because those are both reliably Democratic strongholds. So that's what they're talking about doing. Well, of course, they weren't the only ones talking about this. We had Chris Cuomo and Don Lemon on CNN having their own bits of speculation. Clip 9. Clip 9.
Until you have a group of people that decide to consistently be better than what they reject, you're going to have people in the exact position they are right now, Don, which is no matter what happens, everybody sticks with
their
team.
We're going to have to blow up the entire system. And you know what we're going to have to do?
I don't know.
What you have to do?
You just got to vote.
Honestly, from what your closing argument is, you're going to have to get rid of the Electoral College. Because the people...
I don't see it.
Because the minority in this country decides who the judges are and they decide who the president is.
You need a constitutional amendment to do that.
And if Joe Biden wins, Democrats can stack the courts and they can do that amendment and they can get it passed.
Well, you need two-thirds vote in the Congress and three-quarters of the state legislatures.
They may be able to do that.
Maybe, but that's a tall task. I think if people vote, if you had 80% participation in our elections...
I'm in so much trouble, you know why.
It's your show. What's better than this? Everybody, what do people say when
all
they
right,
stop
that's
us
enough.
On the street?
You hear them, what they're saying. Let's do away with the Electoral College. How about let's do what Ruth Bader Ginsburg wanted to do and just do away with the Constitution? And she's not the only person. The left does not want to be constrained by those kinds of rules and regulations. They want whatever they want. They're kind of like your kids who want to throw out all the rules and rebel completely. And that's what the left wants. It's pretty frightening. I want to just share with you, last night, I think it was last night in Portland, yesterday, somewhere in the last 24 hours, Black Lives Matter blocked in a truck. It was just a truck. Doesn't look fancy. It's a guy, two guys in a truck. Their windows are down. They won't let them pass. And they shout that they must say Black Lives Matter. Hold up their fist and shout and say Black Lives Matter. We didn't pull the clip, but over and over again. And these guys were just stopped. They couldn't move because, you can't run over them because then you get arrested. So this guy in the truck looks like a tough guy, lifts up his fist. And they finally, after going back and forth, say it, say it, say it, say Black Lives Matter. He said it, and so they finally let him go. But that's the kind of intimidation. In another city, I saw a video of a guy, and this is really ironic. My understanding is this was a guy who was a protester who went in support of, this is Antifa, in support of Antifa. And he was, hitting a bat on the ground very ominously. Well, there had been some kind of communication to go out that the Proud Boys were going to be, gathering in that area on that day. But Proud Boys, I guess, set them up because they did not go, none of them. It turned out just to be Antifa that showed up. And so this guy is trying to threaten someone with this bat. Some others think that he's with the Proud Boys, and they chase him. They chase him to his car, and you can see the whole video. They bang it. He's got a beautiful SUV. They bang on it. They ruin it. They kick it. They bash in the back window, and they chase him off, and they won't listen. He's one of them, but they won't listen. And so that I wanted to play another clip for you. It's Kamala Harris. She's supporting Black Lives Matter, and she talks about what a wonderful movement it is. By the way, Black Lives Matter just took off all their information off of line yesterday because, in their own words, they are a communist organization that wants to do away with the nuclear family. Don't have time to read all that to you, but you can't find it on the internet now. We will put that on our Facebook page so you can print it out and still share it with your friends. All right, well, that's it for today. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.